I don't necessarily think that drinking is unhealthy.
Right.
I think what is unhealthy is the way that we drink.
Hello there, and welcome to episode 11 of The Real Podcast, brought to you, as always, by Real Kombucha, now being served in around 60 Michelin-starred restaurants as the ideal alternative to a champagne or a Prosecco. Our podcasting community is growing all the time, thank you very much for that, and we're publishing a new interview every week, so make sure you click those subscribe buttons to keep up. Now, for this episode, we sat down with Tim Etherington-Judge, a man who needs no introduction if you're in the world of spirits and cocktails. He's a former brand ambassador for a well-known whiskey label, and Tim's life was the stuff of dreams for many people. It was literally his job to fly around the world, go to bars, and drink whiskey. Some kind of Instagram heaven, right? Well, apparently not. As you might imagine, that kind of lifestyle is going to take its toll eventually. And as Tim explains with brutal honesty and openness in the following interview, his mental health took a nosedive and he ended up all alone in a hotel room in a very dark place indeed. However, through hard work and with a lot of support from his international friends network, he's come out on top. In the months following his breakdown, Tim realised that his sole purpose from here on in had to be helping others in the hospitality world to reach out whenever they needed assistance. And he set up an organisation called Healthy Hospo, which offers people involved in the alcohol industry a chance to improve their relationship with drink and turn towards a more rounded and healthy lifestyle. But of course, it's far better if you hear it from him. So we'll be chatting about all of that, as well as getting his thoughts on why the world's best mixologists and bartenders are making sobriety far more sexy. Get yourself comfy. We're going in. I guess the first question is, what is Healthy Hospo?
So Healthy Hospo is a not-for-profit organisation aimed at building a healthier, happier hospitality industry for everyone that works in the industry, no matter whether you're a bar back, a waiter, you work as a brand ambassador or a bartender, a chef, barista. We just want to try and build a healthier industry for everyone.
And how long have you been doing that now?
So we officially launched in January 2018 with a wellness workshop in London, which was held in Clapton. We had about 100 people turn up for the very first all-day workshop based around health and wellness in the industry. And it was just fantastic. Sponsored by Real Kombucha. You're one of our partners there on the day, which is fantastic.
So was it immediately something that other people saw as resonating with themselves, or...?
It's been a mix. So it's been a mix of kind of the older generation who've been in the industry, you know, maybe for like 15 years or more. They recognised a lot of the things that we're talking about, and a lot of them have come back, you know, with comments of like, I wish this had been around 10 years ago. Like, it really would have helped. And then a lot of the younger generation who have grown up, you know, with different experiences and different attitudes, realise the benefits of it right from the start. So we get a lot of young people coming in right at the very beginning of their career, because we're seeing a changes in their needs and what they deem to be important.
So when you're talking about the industry, you're talking about bartenders, pub owners, right through to entertainers, or?
Yeah, I mean, basically we would never turn anyone away if they came to us for help. We focus on hospitality, which is about 10% of the global workforce. So we mainly work with bars, restaurants, food outlets, hotels, so those kind of people, and businesses.
Right. Okay. And it's not just you, is it? There's a few of you now sort of involved in it.
Yeah. So it was started by me right from the very beginning. I had some help from Camille Vidal, who's gone on to set up La Maison Wellness. And now we've got a few people around the world who are working on a part-time, occasional basis. So I've got an amazing lady in America called Christine Bocchino.
Right.
He runs everything over in the US, which is fantastic. And then Paulina, who is our Finnish representative. And then I have Caitlin, who really helps out on social media. Right. over here in the UK.
Is it? Do you notice a difference in the amount of necessity for something like this according to the country that you're doing it in?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Which country needs it more?
America, always.
Yeah.
America, because America doesn't have the safeguard, you know, that safety net of a public healthcare system, of any sort of kind of government welfare programs. They're just not, you know, the government there just doesn't look after their stuff. So you've got the private healthcare problems. Plus you've got a tip-based culture, which again leads to additional problems.
What sort of thing would that be? People.
So for example, if you work in the US and you get sick, or you injure yourself somehow, because there's no statutory sick day requirements.
Yeah.
So it's all very much dependent upon state or employers and whether they provide sick pay or not.
Right. Yeah.
If you get sick, and because it's a tip-based culture, if you don't work, you don't get paid.
Right.
So you're kind of walking on this financial tightrope of you have to turn up to get paid, and also there's no consistency to your pay. So, you know, you could go to work one day and it could be raining like really hard, so no one comes out. And because you're on a tip-based pay and you're not really being paid an hourly wage to survive, because no one's coming to the restaurant or to the bar, you don't earn any money.
Got you.
So yeah. You don't have this kind of, not only do you have the problems with the health, you also have this kind of financial anxiety and stress adding on top of everything else. And then you kind of, they tend to work a lot longer and because they don't have that financial security.
Hmm. I see. What was the background for you? I know, if you don't mind me asking, there's a sort of personal story behind wanting to launch Healthy Hospital, isn't there? Do you mind talking about that?
Yeah, definitely. It was born out of my own personal experiences. So yeah. I've been in the industry for 25 years now.
Wow, okay.
So from, you know, a variety of roles. From, you know, I started off in Cornwall, working in little coffee shops.
Is that where you're from?
Yeah, I'm
from Cornwall. Okay.
But down in Cornwall, they're the only jobs in the summer. It's a very touristy area, so there's plenty of hospitality jobs in the summer, and not a lot of jobs for anyone in the winter. So most people end up working in some form of hospitality during the summer. And eventually found my way behind the bar and becoming a bartender, and just fell in love with being a bartender and everything that it brought. So for the last kind of 6.5 years of my career behind the bar, I was what they call a brand ambassador. So I was traveling the world promoting a variety of brands, basically teaching people how to drink, how to make cocktails, and just being like the kind of the face of the brand in markets.
Who was that with?
That was with Diageo.
Diageo, okay. Yeah. See, that's something that, as somebody who's only relatively new to the drinks industry, the idea of a brand ambassador is quite new to me. I mean, I've also met Cammy, who you mentioned earlier, and there's a blog with her on our website. Yeah. And she was one too, wasn't she?
So, yeah, she was for Saint-Germain.
So how does that work? How does one become a brand ambassador for a drinks brand?
In the drinks industry, brand ambassadors are usually recruited from the bartending world. So it'll be, you know, someone who's maybe a high-profile bartender who has an affinity for that brand or that category, is then picked up and given that role. Essentially, the role of a brand ambassador is to be the representative for that brand in the entree.
So is it like a salesperson, or is it more like a sort of model?
It's more like no, it's definitely not a model. So the traditional kind of, you probably think about brand ambassadors as pretty girls or pretty boys.
Got you. Yeah.
Who are just there to be a bit of eye candy.
Yeah.
The brand ambassadors, like the professional brand ambassadors in the drinks world, are very much extremely highly educated on the category, highly educated on the brand, very well respected within the industry. And they're there to educate people about the brand and about the category, and be the kind of the face of it in that brand, because you can't, whoever creates the brands, they can't be there in person all the time. So you have these people to come and build advocacy. So it's not necessarily a sales role. It's more trying to kind of build education and advocacy with the brand. So bartenders want to pour it, so people go, I met that person from that brand.
Got you.
Therefore, I'm going to buy that brand because now I have a personal connection with somebody from the brand.
Sure, yeah.
And it's a job that's as old as alcohol. It's
right.
Always been.
Yeah.
Brand ambassadors. And traditionally, for small brands, and they would have started off as the owners or the founders of the brand, going out and talking about it.
Yeah.
And eventually, kind of the brand gets so big that one owner, one founder isn't enough.
Sure, of course. Yeah. Especially in this sort of, I suppose, multinational world that we live in now.
Yeah,
you definitely must have been jetting around a lot.
It was, yeah. So I've been to, I went to 63 countries with that job.
In the space of how long?
6.5 years.
Wow.
So it was about 100 flights a year.
Nice for your carbon footprint.
Oh, that's terrible. Terrible. I'm so glad that I've traveling a lot less now. So it was kind of traveling around the world, having a job that when you told people what you did, everybody was like, oh my God, how do I get that job?
Yeah, of course.
It's like, hey, I travel the world and drink whiskey for a living. And they're like, oh my God, that's amazing. And on the sound, on the cusp of it, it sounds amazing. And if anyone's was looking at my social media, again, it would be amazing, because you only really show people the good sides of things. You never show people the truth.
Yes, absolutely. It's a problem that we have generally with social media, right?
Yeah, definitely. So it was 100 flights a year, maybe 250 days of the year away from home.
Right.
Sometimes.
Wow.
Constantly jet lagged. Sleep patterns were just, there was no routine, no consistency.
You must have never known where you were.
No, there were, yeah, exactly. You know, kind of the hardest part was trying to remember your room, your hotel room number. That, and then also because you're away from home so much, you're just reliant upon restaurant food or hotel food, room service. So you're not eating a particularly healthy diet. Exercise goes out the window.
Yes, of course.
Because I would always take my running shoes with me, but always be so busy, and you're kind of like, right, I'm in the market now. If I've got 2 days, I have to give everything to them. I don't have time to go running, or I'm too tired because I've just got off a 12-hour flight and I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
So exercise went out the window, and exercise is something that's extremely important to me.
And then
there's the loneliness from being away from home all the time. Your friends kind of forget who you are a little bit because you're always away from home. And it kind of got to me eventually. Oh, and then there's the drinking on top of that. So it's a job where...
Sounds like being a rock star or something.
Yeah, some brand ambassadors do think they're rock stars, that's for sure.
Huh.
And the drinking is... Because you are representing an alcohol brand, and I was representing a bourbon brand at the end.
Hmm.
You're expected to drink the brand. And you land in a market, you go and do some work, and then they take you... You have to go out and do market visits. So you go out and you visit some of the bars, and every bartender that you meet in every bar, they're really excited to see you. They want to show their drinks to you. They want to have a shot with you. So drinking consumption is extreme.
Mm. Did you sort of recognize how much you were drinking each day, or does it become a sort of point where you...
You just don't count anymore. I would have been drinking when I was away from home, like on the road, probably at least a bottle of half a whiskey a week.
Right.
Maybe more.
Wow. Yeah, I never did that at the height of my drinking period. So.
Yeah, and it's, that combined with all of the other stuff just eventually led to not a very good time for me. So 2016 was the year of the beginning of that, was the kind of year of the most hectic piece of travel I'd ever done. And that combined with a change within Diageo internally. So I had a new boss.
Mm-hmm.
And when you kind of, you're in these roles, you rely very heavily upon a close team.
Yeah.
Because you're traveling so much.
Right.
You need to have, you need human connection.
Of course,
it's just a fundamental human need for everyone. And you need to have a team that understands what you're going through, where you are, you've got people to talk to, and you feel part of something. And that all changed at the kind of middle of 2016. And that, I guess, was the straw that broke the proverbial camel.
Mm-hmm.
And everything just came crashing down very quickly from there.
Mm.
And 2016 Athens Bar Show, which was November, I'd lost all hope. I reached a point of hopelessness for the future. So I went to the bar show, did my chat on bourbon to the bartenders, went back to my hotel room with the intention of committing suicide.
Right.
With a bottle of whiskey and a lot of painkillers.
Wow. Yeah. And what pulled you through that moment?
A lot of vomiting.
So you actually got to the point of actually attempting that?
Yeah. Mm. I did attempt it. Got through that and was kind of, as you can imagine, feeling extremely lost and extremely fragile, but decided to, as a kind of cry for help, I wrote a very long Facebook post detailing my lifelong struggles with mental health. Right. I was first diagnosed with depression at the age of 16.
Right, okay.
Back in Cornwall. And also kind of my struggles with that and also the industry and my role as an ambassador. And I guess I wrote that post as a bit of a cry for help, thinking, you know, I was in such a lonely place and such a dark place at the time, thinking that if I got lots of nice messages from people, you know, on Facebook telling me how much they love me and care for me, that would make me feel better and help me out of the hole. And it did, but that wasn't what changed my life. So as a response of the post, I got hundreds and hundreds of messages from people on social media, you know, private messages telling me of their struggles, their problems, struggles of friends that they have, all related to kind of mental health, the industry. And I was like, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people writing to me privately,
yeah,
to tell me about this. Why is no one doing anything about it? You know, why are we still carrying on as if we're all like a never-ending party and there's never going to be any consequences for our actions?
Yeah.
So that was the kind of the moment that I realized that something needed to change.
Yeah.
And that I had to be the man to try and do something. I had no idea what I was going to do. But at that moment, I was like, you know, I've got to be someone that tries to change the industry. Because I would, you know, what kind of man would I be if I just turn my back on everyone, knowing that there's all these people suffering,
sure,
and struggling, if I just went, ah, you're on your own, and just walked away?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, that was the moment that, I guess, Healthy Hospital was born.
Wow, okay. I'd read your story, mm-hmm, before. I hadn't realised it had got quite so low.
Yeah, I definitely scraped the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, well, thank goodness that you started climbing back out again.
Yeah,
how did you go then? So once you'd realised that you'd... Mm-hmm. That Healthy Hospo was what you needed, yep, to do. Were you straight to Diageo and saying, I'm done with this job? Or
no? So Diageo were great in, you know, kind of supporting me through therapy. So I went through recovery. And so I had 7 months of therapy and recovery and to try and get myself back to a, mm-hmm, back to a place, and tried to work with Diageo to get me back to a place of work. But unfortunately, yep, we couldn't find a way for that to happen. So I left Diageo in July 2017.
Right.
But one thing I'd been doing during my recovery was blogging about my recovery.
Yeah.
You know, so telling people what I was going through and how I was dealing with everything. Yeah. And that seemed to get quite a good response. So that led me to thinking, you know, let's get Healthy Hospital going. So whilst I was going through that 7 month period, I purchased all the social media handles that I needed and registered a company, so I was all ready to go when I left. And it was, I had no idea what to do. I knew a little bit about social media, and I knew I could set everything up, and I knew I could build a basic website on WordPress. So that was enough for me to kind of start.
Yeah. And so you, presumably you knew people like Cammy then at, mm-hmm, through work, so yep, you reached out to her and got people involved in that way.
Yeah, exactly. So as soon as I started, kind of, I put a little website up and it just had a few blog posts and some other stuff, and just began talking to people. Put a date in the diary for our launch, which was January 15th,
yeah,
2018. And once that kind of date was in there to have the event, then it all kind of snowballed from there.
Mm. Hmm. Did you? So you said that when you posted your Facebook post, a lot of people kind of crawled out of the woodwork to tell you that they'd had a similar experience. I mean, I have to say, I never got quite to the lows that you got, but I also dealt with mental health issues throughout my life. And there was a point where I was feeling particularly low, probably around 2012, I think. And I blogged as well.
Okay.
Amazing, the amount of response that you get. As you say, you sort of initially think I'm going to get a response of, something that makes me feel better. But actually, you get a response that makes you realise that there are people out there who have been crying out for a way to articulate those feelings, and you've kind of helped them with that. It's a large part of why I'm so heavily involved in sort of offering people a non-alcoholic alternative now, because as a non-drinker myself, it's a sort of a point of social good, I suppose, to do that. But when you reached out on that Facebook post, were the people who were responding to you largely, did you notice a lot of them were from the entertainment industry?
Yeah, so obviously there's a mix of friends, acquaintances, strangers, some very well-known people in the global drinks industry. So it's a whole variety of people, people from media, few entertainers that I know, but obviously because it was on Facebook, it was mostly people who are within my circle of connection.
Of course,
And it was surprising, the number of people and also the scope, the range of people that wrote to me was a real surprise.
Have you found that since starting it that it's been something that has been easily accepted by the industry, that the offering that you're giving,
absolutely.
So it's something that was just waiting to happen then?
Yeah, it is. So everyone has accepted it, been extremely positive about it. We've gone from in 18 months since we started officially. Now we're working with most of the major liquor companies in the world. We've done events for all over the world as well.
When you say you're working with the major liquor companies, what do you do with them?
It depends on who we're working with and what they want to do. So we do everything from writing training programs for them to helping them curate events. One thing we say is it's always got to fit the brand or the company we're working with. And it's got to be something that doesn't feel like it's shoehorned in. So for example, we work with Martini.
Right.
On their cycling program called Ciclismo, which is a fantastic program to get bartenders into cycling.
Right, okay.
But it's based on the fact that they went back through their history and they discovered that the first ever thing they sponsored was a cycling team.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it linked back through their history and their heritage.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing program to get bartenders on bikes, and get them doing something that doesn't just involve drinking.
Sure,
it's so you can engage with the brand in a whole new way.
Yeah,
and the program's just been phenomenal.
But how does something like, just as a sort of challenge here, how does something like Martini, how does someone like Martini sort of promote healthy life at the same time as promoting something that's an unhealthy thing to do.
I don't necessarily think that drinking is unhealthy.
Right.
I think what is unhealthy is the way that we drink.
Right,
Alcohol in itself is something that has been around since the birth of civilization.
Sure.
And it can bring many positives through social connection and community, which are quite often not talked about enough when it comes to good health.
Right.
We talk about nutrition, and we talk about exercise, and we've started to talk about sleep, but few of us talk about the importance of social connection and community. And particularly low ABV options like Martini, I think, can play a big part in that. And it's something that we definitely advocate at Healthy Hospo. It's not the drinking that's the problem, it's how we're drinking that's the problem. Because if you look at... So there's a guy called Dan Buettner who wrote a book called The Blue Zones Project.
The?
Blue Zone Project.
Blue Zone
Project. So he went around the world looking for the longest lived communities in the world.
Okay.
So the communities that have the most number of centenarians.
Yeah.
And then tried to link you know, find common associations between them. Sure. So there's five communities that he found that range from some crazy religious people in California through to the very well documented residents of Okinawa in Japan.
Yeah.
And he came up with nine kind of attributes that they all share. So with the exception of the seven-day Adventists in California, who are these religious people, every single one of those communities drinks.
Right, okay.
But they have strict rules around how they drink.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not going out on a Friday night and binging. And
yeah.
It's regular, small amounts.
Yeah.
Always with food and always with community and with people. So it's always in a social setting. It's always a small amount, always, you know, kind of with food. So, and that's the importance of it. It's that community that it builds. You know, every community in the world has some sort of, or almost every community in the world has some sort of communal space where people come and consume alcohol.
I mean, thinking back to my time in Japan, it's interesting that the Japanese have a system called Nijikai, Enkai and Nijikai, Sanjikai. Basically, it means the first party, the second party, the third party. And if you're working in a business, then the Enkai is expected of you every now and again. And it's a party, but they never really ever lasted more than 2 hours. At the end of 2 hours, everybody just shut down and went home or went to the second party if they were invited. So it was, thinking about it now, it's quite a gated way of drinking. And it's accepted. It's part of the culture. It's a cultural norm. So, you know, as a typical drinking Brit at the time, I used to find it incredibly frustrating that you'd get 2 hours into a party and you'd just be getting your buzz on and everybody would pack up and go home.
Yeah.
But I guess it made sense now.
It does. And if you look at the kind of the aperitif or the aperitivo moment in France and Italy, you know, there it's a way of drinking. You know, it's low ABV. It's with food to celebrate. You know, just people coming together and talking and having a long chat before dinner. And I think that's really good because it's that community that the alcohol gives that's really good for our health. Yet, you know, we don't really look at it that in many terms. We look at the effects of alcohol on the body through the lens of nutrition or other things rather than a more holistic communal element. So that's kind of why we still work with alcohol. And also there's no point kind of, if we're trying to change things for the better across the industry, there's no point just kind of almost biting the hand that feeds, but kind of just pointing and going, this is all bad, so never do it, because people will just turn off from our messaging.
Yes, of course.
So we come with a message of responsible drinking and sensible drinking.
Yeah.
And also giving people an alternative to drinking. So the Martini platform is quite good for that, because it's what we've found is that when people have a reason not to drink, they're much less likely to drink. So rather than telling them, don't drink because it's bad for your health, go, hey, if you drink less, you'll be faster on the bike and you'll be fitter. And they got so into the competitive nature rocks up, and also they start to cycle, so they feel a bit better. So they're like, oh, I want to do more of this, or I'm going for a ride tomorrow, so I'm not going to drink tonight.
Yeah.
So you're giving them people a reason not to drink, rather than kind of being the wagging finger going, oh, drinking's bad for your health.
Of course,
And that's far, far more effective.
Yeah. Do you find that, we see loads of stats in the media at the moment about how people are drinking less. And do you find that people are, what am I trying to say? I suppose is that when you're in the industry and you look at those sort of stats, sometimes I feel like I'm in a bit of a bubble. Like, of course, I'm surrounded by people who are conscious drinkers. Yeah. You know, they every now and again, I'll step outside of the bubble. So, for example, this weekend, we just went and did an event where we were sampling people with real kombucha. And you'll meet a lot of people who, you know, your average Joe on the street, who will be like, Friday night, non-alcoholic drink, are you mad? Yeah. And, you know, just what I'm noticing, I think, I'm not sure if it's an anecdotal thing or there's any stats, or the stats are actually to be believed, but what I'm noticing, I think, is that that's becoming less. People are becoming more conscious of what they're drinking.
Absolutely. I've seen it firsthand. You just have to go to the bar, you know, any of the top bars around the city right now, and see how the non-alcoholic offering has gone from maybe a J2O or a Coke or a cup of tea to, you know, now full-on cocktails, with some accounts offering every single one of their cocktails in an alcoholic or a non-alcoholic version. So it's about not being removed from that moment. I went to one of my favorite cocktail bars in the world on Friday night to meet a friend. So it's Happiness Forgets.
Happiness Forgets.
In Hoxton. Okay. And she's a very well-known wine sommelier and expert.
Okay.
But she's not drinking. You know, she's taken some time out from drinking, which is fine. And she sat down and she told the bartender, you know, do you have anything in non-alcoholic? And normally that would have come across, you know, got given the response of, oh, you've got a J2O or Coke, or maybe you've got an orange juice.
Something very sugary.
Yeah, but it got the response, oh, what kind of style of drink do you like?
Wow, interesting.
And we got two different cocktails, both non-alcoholic. The second one we got was the best drink that any of us had.
Mm-hmm.
They were better than my alcoholic drinks. Absolutely delicious.
What made it so?
Just the kind of the flavour, the complexity of the drink.
I suppose, I just threw in the word sugary just now. Yeah. I suppose the kind of common assumption of what a non-alcoholic cocktail would be is something that's little more than a mixed fruit juice or something like that.
Yeah, exactly, because that's how they were for such a long time. Mm. But with the kind of the rise of, I mean, it all started with Seedlip and Brent Branson, who I think is probably the most influential person in the industry, or the person who has had the biggest impact on changing the industry in recent years. You know, you've gone from just being Seedlip on the market to now you've probably got 15 different non-alcoholic spirits brands in the UK alone.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible to see the rapidity of change and the way that a lot of people have responded to it so well. You know, bartenders have really embraced it, or the good bartenders have really embraced it and seen it as a new challenge, which is fantastic. And it's giving people, you know, because before it used to be, you know, if you went out and you weren't drinking, and you'll have experienced this, and all your mates are drinking cocktails and having fun, and and you go out and you're not, and then you kind of feel a bit like Billy No Mates.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, you guys are all having fun with your drinks, and I'll just sit here with my glass of water. Or But now you can partake in that moment with them. Just because your drink doesn't have alcohol in it doesn't mean that it's any less well-crafted or any less delicious or doesn't look as beautiful.
That's, I mean, the phrase that you say there, the well-craftedness is the important thing, isn't it? I mean, it's, of course it is about flavour and having something, but it's about I interviewed the founder of Lucky Saint, non-alcoholic beer, recently. It's on our podcast. You can hear it there as well. He was talking about how in the world of non-alcoholic beer, there had been what he referred to as a that'll do mentality. The idea of crafting something non-alcoholic was almost like a time waster. So the non-alcoholic beers would be whatever the cheapest one was and then de-alcoholized.
Like Caliber and
Yeah, that's around the time that I started not drinking. Caliber was pretty much the only thing you had.
It was Caliber and then Bitburger Drive. Well, Bitburger Drive was slightly different because that was the first one that was even slightly serious.
Bavaria,
yeah,
which would tasted like a sort of bad fruit juice.
Beck's Blue,
which dominated for a long time. Heineken Zero now, not so bad. My go-to is still Lucky Saint. I had one the other night and it was amazing. But, that moment, that that mentality, that'll do mentality, I think is... That's what we're talking about here, isn't it? It's the change in mentality from that to actually that won't do. People who are not drinking need that moment as well.
I think from a producer point of view, definitely. And I think from a consumer or drinker's point of view, it's the inclusion is really important. Because you're no longer excluded from the moment, from the fun, because you've chosen to drink something else. You've just chosen that your thing, which is identical to everyone else's, just doesn't have alcohol in it. I think that's key for the drinker.
You said just now that I thought it was interesting that you used the word the good bartenders. So those out there that are, I suppose they're genuinely interested in their craft and how to better their craft and that kind of thing, and they're embracing the idea of non-alcoholic cocktails. Can you name any that you think are doing particularly good things in that area?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many of them now. One that kind of, I think, deserves a lot of praise. There's a couple who deserve a lot of praise. A lady called Anna Walsh, who is the bar manager at the Virgin Mary in Dublin, which is Ireland's first non-alcoholic cocktail.
And that's not just a pop-up, right? That's a full-time.
No, that is a full-time, 100% real gig. And it's probably the best bar I've been to all year.
Really?
And I definitely think it's one of the most important bars in the world right now. It's
where is it in Dublin? Is it in Temple?
It's in the centre. I can't tell you exactly where it is. But it's just fantastic. It's the only non-alcoholic bar I've been to that's a proper 100% cocktail bar. You know, you walk in, you get a non-alcoholic wine, a sparkling wine on arrival. It's a little kind of a welcome. They carry a full selection of beers, wines, spirits and cocktails, all non-alcoholic, kombuchas. The drinks are just so delicious. You know, you would never complain and go like, oh, I want something with alcohol because the drinks are so good. And then they've just, some of the stories they tell when I was sitting in there with Anna, just some of the stories of how that bar has impacted people's positivity. She told me the story of a son and his father came into the bar and they both had a couple of beers. And the son kind of came over at the end just in tears, saying, thank you so much. You know, I'm 25, 26 years old and I've never been able to go out for a beer with my father because he's a recovering alcoholic.
Mm.
But now this is the first time we've ever been out for a beer together. Lovely. And have that kind of like father and son bonding moment.
Yeah.
So they're opening up amazing opportunities like that and people, you know, but they're getting people coming in, like, you know, people on stag do's or hen nights coming in because they want a bit of a break from the drinking. So they'll come in, have a couple of drinks there, and then maybe go back to the hen.
Yeah.
They have lots of bartenders come in. So sometimes bartenders will come in for a drink before they go into shift or after their shift.
Wow, okay.
And it's just, it's magic. So that bar is really changing a lot. It's getting a lot of very well-deserved attention as well.
Sure.
I think it's just a fantastic spot. And another bartender called, a guy called Paul Matthew.
Paul Matthew.
Yeah, so he's owner of a few bars in London, like The Hyde in Bermondsey.
Yeah.
Which specialises in London or UK-based products.
Right.
But he's recently launched a non-alcoholic product called Everleaf.
Yes, I know that.
Which is just fantastic. It's kind of a bitter aperitif.
Yes.
Based on saffron and vanilla and other ingredients, and it's absolutely delicious, and is really being accepted as a kind of a non-alcoholic version of maybe an Aperol. You know, it's really delicious in a spritz.
Right. Okay.
Packed full of flavour.
Yep.
And he's done amazing things, so I think those two as bartenders are doing amazing stuff.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's quite a few of the people that I work with are meeting more and more bar staff or pub owners who are actually teetotal now.
Yeah.
Fascinating world that we're moving into.
Well, it's really the only industry in the world where it's publicly, you know, it's acceptable to drink at work or to be drunk at work.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's actively encouraged. It's weird. Like, I was in Australia, in Perth. And they were telling me there that if you work for a mining company, every day when you turn up to shift, you get breathalyzed.
Wow, okay.
Because they had such a problem with drinking.
And, yes, of course.
And so everyone gets breathalyzed. It's not a stretch of the imagination for people to wonder if you give a bartender a breathalyzer, what they try and do with it.
Yeah, of course. You know,
it's like, what's the biggest number we can rack up on here? But I think there's definitely a big change now. Owners are realizing that if their staff are not drinking at work, they're performing better, making less mistakes, their health is better. And bartenders are also starting to realize it as well. You know, that maybe drinking every single night on the job is not the best idea.
No. What do you suggest or recommend to people who feel like, you know, perhaps people in the industry who, I imagine that if you're a bartender in the industry, or certainly a couple of years ago, there would be a sort of certain sense of peer pressure if you were trying.
Yeah, definitely.
So presumably that's lifting slightly, or
it's definitely lifting slightly. There are more bars that I'm seeing now where the bartenders are not drinking behind the bar, which is fantastic. Like Coupette in Bethnal Green is a great example of that. Run extremely professionally, one of the best bars in the world.
Yeah. And not drinking is a conscious decision by them.
It's completely outlawed behind them. So Chris Moore, the owner, is one of the most professional bartenders you'll meet in the industry.
Yeah.
Has just said that you're here to work.
Yeah.
And I need you at 100%.
So. Yeah.
And no one ever complained. You know, none of the staff ever complained. None of the guests ever complained. And now there's so many different options. There's almost no excuse to drink behind the bar. So, for example, one thing that we advocate is the benefits of the post-shift drink.
Right, okay.
So it's quite a common practice, you know. Shift's over, it's a very physically and mentally demanding job, working in hospitality. Extremely stressful at times.
Yes.
So having that drink after work, and kind of, it's just a de-stress moment, you know. Have a bit of a bitch about the night, maybe about some of the customers, and you just get stuff off your mind, get it out into the open. So when you go home, you've had that release, and you feel a bit better. But traditionally, it's always been done maybe with a beer.
Yeah.
But now you've got so many options of non-alcoholic beers. You know, it's switch out that after work beer for the non-alcoholic option.
Yeah.
You still get all of the benefits.
Yeah.
From the de-stressing moment and getting stuff out of your head, but you're not taking on any alcohol, which will then, having it late at night before you sleep is going to impact your sleep.
Of course.
And have those negative effects. So little things like that can be really good. And now you've got so many great non-alcoholic spirits. You know, if you want to have shots behind the bar, because it's a nice kind of, you know, you're in the weeds.
Yeah.
And everything's going wrong. And it's that little bit of the moment where the team come together and kind of like, we're in this together. But, you know, it doesn't have to be a shot of 45% whiskey.
No, of course.
You know, even if just moving it down to a low alcohol, or now there are so many non-alcoholic options.
Yeah.
You still get that moment of camaraderie and togetherness, which I think is really important.
Yeah.
But you're not taking the alcohol.
So when you've got this, say there's somebody who's particularly feeling that peer pressure and wants to get out, not necessarily leave the industry, but wants to make a difference. What are the first steps that you talk to them about?
I think a lot of people do it out of maybe a fear of that, or an expectation of that's just what has to be done. You know, I have to do this to move forward. It's almost like a rite of passage that it must be done.
Yeah.
Without ever challenging that and realizing, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. I'm fortunate enough now that I'm in the position where I'm confident enough to say no. So one of my rules around drinking is no shots.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where I am or who I'm drinking with. No shots. And I think it's just having that realization that you don't have to, and no one's really going to judge you if you don't. Maybe a little bit at the start, you might get a bit of peer pressure.
Yeah.
But very soon, people kind of develop expectation, and they're like, oh, you know, they don't drink, so we're not gonna do that. So it's about setting that kind of expectation for people. If they know that you're not drinking, and because the industry has changed so much in like the last 2 or 3 years, there's a lot more understanding of the reasons why people are not drinking. And some of the top bartenders in the world, so people like Jack McGarry or Giuseppe Gonzalez, are teetotal bartenders.
Amazing.
And they're some of the highest performing, most respected bartenders in the industry.
Yeah. You yourself, am I wrong in thinking that you are on some mad marathon challenge?
I was.
Oh, you were?
I was. So at the beginning of the year, I decided that I wanted to do some form of physical challenge.
Yeah.
Call it a midlife crisis, and I can't afford a Ferrari. But I reached the age of 42, and I kind of, my outlook on life has changed a lot in the last few years. So it's kind of, I wanted to do, every year I've decided that I want to do something that's extremely memorable for that year, rather than, you know, so often now we just kind of start in January and then we get to December and we're going, oh, where did the year go?
Yes,
we haven't really kind of done anything during the year. So I was like, I wanted to make sure I changed that. So I said to myself that every year now I'm going to do something big. Just one big thing that's going to make that year extremely memorable. And I've always been extremely physically active.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy kind of sports. And the last few years I've got into ultra endurance events.
Okay.
I love the community and I love the kind of the personal challenge of pushing yourself far beyond what most people think is capable. You know, so a few years ago, like a marathon was a big challenge for people.
Sure.
You know? But now, for a lot of people, a marathon is easy. You know, so now it's like a double marathon. 100 miler is, you know, is the, wow. I'd say 100 miler is the new marathon.
Yeah.
You know, and people are beginning to again push the boundaries of what we think is possible.
Sure.
And finding that as soon as you push one boundary of what we think is possible, we can go beyond that boundary.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I did that, and also I wanted to, if I was going to do something, it had to raise a lot of money and awareness around mental health.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a qualified mental health expert.
Sure.
So I can't go and talk, and I can't provide therapy, and Healthy Hospital is not about that, but I can use my platform and this crazy challenge to raise money for the people that do. So that was the goal, to raise money for the Benevolent, the UK drinks industry charity.
Right, okay.
Who have specific mental health programs.
Yeah.
So the challenge was to run 42 marathons in 42 consecutive days at 42 years old.
But?
So it started on July the 20th at an event called Tales of the Cocktail, which is the biggest kind of drinks industry event of the year.
Yeah.
And I trained really hard, and I was in a really good place, and I felt good. But the first marathon ended maybe like the last hour. We just ran through a crazy tropical storm. So, you know, it's like watching the streets flood in front of our eyes. And I think that was that very first marathon was such a challenging one. The weather conditions. That's where all the problems began for the challenge. Because then the second day, the weather was a bit better, and I managed to avoid most of the rain. Then I flew to New York to do the next two, and both of the marathons in New York were under extreme weather warning conditions for flash flooding, and so I ran through two more thunderstorms. And yeah, like temperature-wise, it was really good because it's nice and hot in summer, and then you get the nice cooling rain.
Yeah.
But running in such heavy rain has such an impact on your feet.
Right.
Because your shoes get really, really heavy, and the ground's a little bit, you know, a bit more slippery. So I injured my left foot in one of those first marathons. And that led me to kind of change my running style, because my left foot, the metatarsals, my left foot. So I was running with my kind of left foot turned in a little bit.
See, yeah.
And then kind of clawing my toes, I found it was less painful if I ran like that.
Yeah.
But then that had a knock-on impact of causing the tendon that runs up my shin, or the ligament that runs up my shin, to get very tight.
Right.
And that eventually caused extremely painful shin splints on my left leg. So after 22 and a half marathons, I had to call it a day, ended up in hospital on crutches with a fractured boot, with a stress fracture of the left shin. Caused by the running.
Is it something that you'll get over and head out and do 43 next year or something like that?
Nope. It's something I will get over, and I will finish the rest of the marathons this year.
Nice one.
So I came off the crutches last week.
Okay.
Which is really good, and I've got no fracture boot on anymore. Yeah. It's fantastic. So I'm started to, I even went cycling yesterday.
Oh, wow.
Which is very exciting. So the leg's kind of healing really well and really nicely. So now it's just being patient before I get out and start training again. But I will definitely finish my personal challenge later this year, because the industry was amazing, and the response from the industry to kind of my injury was just, it was so heartwarming. The fact that a few people organized, there was like maybe 20 to 25 bars around the world who on the 28th of August, I think it was, all got together and ran a marathon. So each bar would kind of cumulatively run a marathon between their staff.
Okay.
And that happened all over the world.
Wow.
To help me finish the challenge. So the, you know, we definitely raised money, and we definitely raised awareness for mental health. And we got people kind of, even if they ran for a few hundred meters, we got people doing a bit of exercise and feeling good about themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, the personal challenge of doing this is not done yet. So.
Got to do it.
It will be done. It's got to be done.
Excellent. Good on you.
Thanks.
And thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much for the interview.
Yes, big thanks to Tim for taking the time to tell his inspirational story. Now, in next week's podcast, our very own Shani Higgs will be chatting with an Instagram sensation, Millie Gooch from the rapidly growing Sober Girls Society. Until then, have a great week. We'll see you soon.